This is WGTD. You're listening to Education Matters, the only weekly broadcast in southeastern Wisconsin devoted exclusively to a discussion of local educational issues. Education Matters is co-hosted by Karen Sconsert, an associate professor of education at Carthage College, Jeff Rasmussen, a retired Racine Unified teacher and administrator who currently serves as president of the Racine Area Retired Educators Association, Steve Brown, a retired professor of education leadership, and former Kenosha Unified School Superintendent Joe Manji. Now, here's today's Education Matters moderator.
And a very pleasant good morning and welcome to this edition of Education Matters here on WGTD Public Radio. I'm your host this morning, Steve Brown. It's great to be back on the air after a bit of a hiatus. And I'm very pleased to welcome into Education Matters Heidi Gill. And Heidi is Senior Associate at the National Equity Project, located in Oakland, California. And Heidi is joining us today. I believe you're in San Francisco, correct?
That's true, Steve. I am.
So anyway, before we start, one of the things I always like to do, Heidi, and by the way, we're doing this virtually using Zoom, so for our broadcast, our audience is only hearing your voice. I can see you and you can see me. And I'll let our audience know that I saw you last week as part of a CESA Board of Control meeting, actually a board, our annual conference meeting that we had. And we'll talk a bit about that in a little while. But maybe if you could just tell us a bit about yourself and your background. I always like our audience to know a bit about who our guests are here on Education Matters.
Sure. Well, I've been in education for about 40 years. I have worked for the National Equity Project for the last 18, and we'll talk more about our organization. But prior to that, I did some literacy coaching and consulting for 4 or 5 years. And prior to that, I was a teacher in Wisconsin, actually. I'm from Wisconsin, grew up in Racine, lived in Madison for most of my adult life, and taught in the Madison Metropolitan School District, as well as did some work in some preschools and some nonprofit alternative schools in Madison, as well as actually spent a year out here in San Francisco right after graduating and worked in an alternative school at the time. At the time, I was really interested in some of the innovative work that was happening in alternative schools around the country and wanted to kind of learn about open education and open classroom teaching through that. So I've had a long career in education and was raised by educators. So this is kind of in my blood.
You mentioned your time in Racine. Obviously, WGTD covers Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties. Where in the Racine area did you live?
So I grew up on the north side. I attended Gerstead Eggerholm Elementary and what at the time was junior high, and then Horlick High School. And my mother was a teacher at first at what was Garfield. I think it's got a new name now.
Okay.
And then at Gerstead. So we lived in just within a few blocks and could walk, both of us could walk to school.
Okay, excellent. And I think that's always great to know because our audience always likes to know things like that. And so welcome back via Zoom technology back to the Kenosha Racine area. Let's first talk about the National Equity Project. I've been aware of it through my teaching in graduate school administration, but I would suspect that probably many of our listeners maybe have heard of it, but might not know much about it. So maybe if you can give us an overview.
Sure, sure. So our organization has been around for about 25 years. We actually began as a in the Bay Area, focused in Oakland, began as a Bay Area chapter or part of the Coalition for Equitable Schools. And actually, it was originally a coalition for essential schools. When we started to be involved, we changed the name to Equitable. And I believe it's been at least 10 years, somewhere in that zone, that we moved from being a Bay Area focused organization to national. We were doing national work, and we started to say, let's acknowledge that we are and figure out how do we build our capacity to have a national influence, so that we now have three areas that we work from. We work on the West Coast, we work out of a Denver office for the mountain region, and we actually have a Midwest regional office, which is really everyone's home. We work virtually, but a lot of work being done in Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan in particular. Our organization takes the stance as a coaching organization, in that we are working to build the capacity of leaders in their communities to take on the work of transforming outcomes for children and families that have historically been marginalized, particularly marginalized from success in education, and how that later impacts access to housing, choice of careers, and that sort of thing. We focus particularly on racial inequities. We feel that if we could move the bar and make a change in the way in which people have been marginalized based on race, we will be able to impact change in more broadly, but that it takes a particular focus on racial inequity in order to see that change happening.
I'm sort of jumping ahead. I had this as one of my later questions, but with everything that is going on right now in our nation, the George Floyd murder, other areas related to Black Lives Matter and things of that nature, what kinds of changes have you seen as an educator and someone who's been involved with the National Equity Project? What kinds of major changes have you seen in education, let's say in the last 5 years, based on the work that you and the project have been doing?
That's a great question, Steve. I would say the focus of the change is really on the building of the leadership capacity. So given that I do travel around the country, I can pretty reliably step into a new community and know what their disparities in their outcomes for their young people look like. And it's going to fall along racial and language lines in particular, as well as students with special needs. So when we look at where the gaps across the country, the patterns are way too predictable. So what that says is that it is not about intent or good intentions. It's about the impact. That what we focus on is the way in which leadership begins to do not only the individual personal work, but the systemic work necessary to recognize how systems are continuing to reproduce these same outcomes. So what we're seeing in terms of influence that we are having significantly is on systemic redesign, is I guess the best way I could put it, that we're beginning to work much more, especially in the last 5 years, to help districts as well as community organizations understand that it is the way in which they are designed internally to do their work that needs to shift. That hierarchical design, while it's necessary in some ways, does not actually lead to the change in the impact of the experience for young people. That we actually need to work in partnership all through that system. So the exciting thing is to see shifts happening in individual schools and districts, and now we're working in networks between districts to help leaders learn with and from each other with a little more agility and more facilities, so that we're leaders are learning how to shift their practices and really learn from students' experiences and to shift the impact of student voice. It's exciting work. We can talk more about maybe an example of that later, but that is where we're starting to see a leveraged acceleration of change.
As you're having these conversations and you're talking about change, how is the conversation different when you're talking to school administrators or when you're talking to teachers or when you're talking to school board members? I mean, obviously, when you spoke to those of us as part of the annual conference for CESA, we were all school board members. A number of us were also and are also educators, and we've been teachers, and we've been school administrators. Many of us are parents as well. How do you differentiate your message, or do you differentiate your message based on the audience?
That's a good question. First of all, I want to say that in education, all of us are practitioners. We just have a different role, right? So it's when you use, for instance, we used a metaphor in the session that we had last week about kind of recognizing that this work is personal work. It requires being able to put a mirror up to yourself and say, really, what is it about my identity, about my experience that has shaped my beliefs and what I do? What do I need to examine about that? And when I look at the world around me, I look at my family, the institution I'm a part of, my classroom, what am I understanding about that? What needs to change? So that metaphor works for all of us. And it's a critical way in which we organize our work that each of us, and that when I think of this moment that we're in, what is so critical is that each of us is able to look at the place where we have influence and to say, in my day-to-day interactions, one-to-one with my colleagues and my family, how am I recognizing when I'm hearing a statement being made that is racist, that is what I would say is reproductive? It's reproducing the same result. If we think and talk like that, we're not going to see a change. So how do I interact in my personal zone? And then what's my role? And where do I have influence? So that's necessary for each person to be able to define. Now, it's really important for us as facilitators to have experience in all those places. So we've worked closely with board members and with, we work with district office teams. I work with teacher teams. I've been in the classroom observing teachers and giving feedback there. Being able to know what is the lived experience all through the system so that we're able to help bring back examples of what that shift could look like for folks in the role that they're living in so that you can bring it to the practical level. But the work ultimately falls on those individuals to do that sort of reflective work and the deeper look of examining how they are interacting, what's happening in their system. I'll give you an example of a leader who this week was telling me that once again, she was sitting at the table, which has been going on for weeks on end as administrators saying, how are we going to open in the fall? And she finally said, we are not having the people at the table that we need. We're opening in the fall, but we haven't had students here or parents here to talk about these options. We can't go forward. I got to say that we can't take another step until we bring them to the table. It was phenomenal when they brought those folks to the table in terms of the insight that they gained about what is going to be necessary in that redesign. And they particularly brought families to the table who are families that have been more marginalized, African-American families, Latino families, folks who are parents who are second language learners themselves trying to talk about what this has been like for them. That is the way of bringing it, I think, to the practical level is helping leaders think about what's the move you can make within your context that actually changes the conversation.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you this. In the world now of COVID-19 and with the virtual learning that students were in, many are still in now if they're going to summer school, but as they ended their spring semester, if you will, in our public schools, what have been your impressions and just reactions from those within the National Equity Project that you have seen around the country or even in the Bay Area there, as far as any major inequities with regards to learning that has or has not taken place because of the COVID-19 pandemic?
Mm-hmm. Well, some things are fairly predictable. We certainly know that just even access to the technology, there was a huge disparity all across the country. And then not just to the actual use of a Chromebook, you know, the tool, but the Wi-Fi. And then families, and this cross-cuts income, this piece, here you have a family where there may be five people in that household, both mom and dad trying to get onto online, and then three students trying to get online. So the broadband, the access to Wi-Fi. So all of that has really revealed significant inequities that we have in our systems. But when we go beyond that to say, then what did it look like to engage our students? I taught for 20 years. When I saw the design that's been used significantly across the country, where teachers pre-recorded a lesson and provided, kind of access to, here's your assignments to do, there's no way that my students would have been engaged by that. And I've got five grandkids. None of them were engaged by that. Mm-hmm. So what I think we found is that in families where the parents had time and could provide an adaptation to the learning for their children, for their young people, kids did some interesting learning. For the most part, it was not based on what was being provided by the school. There are certainly exceptions to that. There are teachers that went way above and beyond to really engage and individualize the work. So that's what it is going to take, and that's what's been needed. It was such a very, a slide I didn't use with all of you is just this notion that change is fast, but transition is slow. So it was a very quick change, and the transition to what it means to live in that with all the emotions involved meant that a lot of people were really just not prepared. But it highlighted some significant gaps that we have to address. One is there are teachers that are very strong with social emotional connections with their students, and there are teachers for whom that hasn't been their strength. If teachers had strong relationships going in, kids stayed engaged, and teachers found ways to adapt. If those relationships were not strong with students, kids dropped by the wayside. So it falls in line that we've already had, going into the pandemic, significant numbers of our African American and Latino students who have not felt that they're seen or engaged with their teachers. And there was far less engagement going into the virtual learning for that reason. It's so important that we think, when we design instruction going forward, that the student's identity has to be at the center of that design. How do I know my student? And in what way am I going to use this technology and ways of interacting in ways that connect with their identity? And what are we talking about? What's the content of what we're talking about? If you and I are going to get on to do some learning, I need to know you, what you're interested in, and how you best interface with this kind of technology. How much support do you need? How much do you like to work independently? Who do you want to talk to? There's a lot of ways we can use this technology to be responsive to our students based on their identity, but that's not how we approached it overall.
The National Equity Project has been around for how many years?
25.
If you could talk briefly about, and I'm looking at the website now, the area of core beliefs of the National Equity Project. I've looked at the website before, even before your presentation this past week. And the core beliefs are so strong, and they're even more important today in society and in education. Maybe if you could just talk briefly about some of those core beliefs and why they are so important today.
Sure. So on our website, we list about four of those core beliefs, which really focus on the notion of equity. When in the course of our work with folks, we talk as well about sort of presuppositions that we hold connected to those. So we often begin our work with people by saying that we have to examine the fact that we hold as a core belief and a presupposition that we know our public school system was never designed to meet all students' needs. It was never designed for all young people in the first place. And we have, through the course of history, repeatedly, usually at a state level, created barriers to access. Repeatedly having to do with language, having to do with race, having to do with ability. It wasn't until about 73, 75, that public schools were responsible for educating students with special needs. So, that's a presupposition and a core belief that we have to actually examine how our systems continue to reproduce barriers to success. So one of those core beliefs says that when a system of oppression has been institutionalized, it's unnecessary for individuals to be oppressive. So very often, we as individuals put the mirror up to ourselves and say, hey, I'm not racist, and I have strong relationships with my students, so I don't know why they're not succeeding. But that's an inadequate lens. We have to look at the way the system is set up and what's happening in that system. So to have a belief that the oppression has become institutionalized means I have work to do looking out. Another, I think, really core belief is that we have such critical work to do as leaders for equity, and that it's change is possible, but it's going to take us as leaders for equity actually being able to make those inequities. And when I speak to that, I mean about impact. We have to look at what's been the impact of our work. To not be defensive, if we were doing some great work, we had great intentions, that's wonderful. But if the impact hasn't changed, if we are not hearing from our students that a greater sense of belonging, a greater sense of feeling that my culture is represented in this space. I see myself as a learner belonging in this space, and I'm getting the success I look for. That we as leaders have to recognize that the system, equality is not happening. We have to do something differently. So the idea is being a leader for equity is to make those inequities in outcomes visible, and then to change the way we structure the conversation. That one of the core beliefs is that it's necessary for us to find ways, new ways, to engage and co-design with our communities so that each child learns, thrives, and experiences a sense of belonging. That's not the way we've thought about education. Historically, and probably in most countries, the idea of sort of the maestro, you know, the someone who I know everything, I'm bringing it to you, means that I'm actually not, if I bring that approach to my teaching, I'm not adapting to how you are as a learner and the necessity of co-design.
when you were just talking about the maestro and you know, the talking down to students, mm-hmm. you know, irrespective of who the students are and who the maestro is, as you look at the work that you do and the National Equity Project does when you go out and you do your workshops, what kinds of materials do you use? Because I know, you know, I've looked at some of the topics of the webinars. I've looked at the resources that you have on the website. But how do you choose those materials? How do you make sure that you're not choosing materials that would make the audience or some members of the audience feel as mm-hmm. if you're talking down to them? Because mm-hmm. I always have to be careful when as a professor, as a teacher, to make sure that I never do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, a combination of things, I think, is that we try to be both transparent about our beliefs so that you as a participant are not trying to read between the lines to say, what's their agenda? It's like, we're very clear about our agenda. So that, I think, is a critical piece. Another is that using facts from history, events from history, photos from history, and making connections through our own experience. So it's important in our engagement that we walk the talk. If what I've said to you is that I can't teach you and reach you if I don't know you, that all of our work is about really engaging that deep reflection on the part of the learner and the idea of a voluntary principle that you're going to bring to the story what you choose to. So the kinds of engagements that we organize have a lot of interaction among participants. You met our work in a virtual space, but if you were with us in a physical space, there's a lot of opportunity for people to get up, meet each other, and have a conversation. We give a prompt, we give some information, but it's significantly about the reflection that you go through and the story that you have to bring. Narrative is where we make this meaning, and often many of us have thought that I don't have a story to tell. There's a real danger in feeling that we don't have stories to tell and our students don't have stories to tell. So we activate a lot of the use of narrative so that we all become more aware and more self-aware of what is informing my opinion and my story. And what is it for you? And how can I begin to bring an understanding of your perspective to my thinking? I can't get that if there's too much constraint. There has to be a lot of opportunity for that sharing. Now, I will say that we often suggest an arc of learning initially for a set of leaders that helps people have some common language around the sort of history of events that have occurred in education, so that when we say there is systemic oppression that exists institutionally, we have some common knowledge of where that's coming from, and that has fed our internalized bias that is implicit in us. We don't even realize how it's been formed. But we have to make more transparent where all that has come from. So that's the interface between the materials and the story that help people begin to navigate some key concepts in that initial work. Does that help with kind of giving? Is that a good answer, or else what could be helpful there?
Yeah, no. That's actually, that really ties it together well. I was looking at your that one area on the website, recorded webinars, and mm-hmm. and the one that's entitled Equity 101, mm-hmm. and it's entitled Starting the Equity Conversation, and you've already alluded to that, and it says the word equity is everywhere these days, And when I read that the first time, you know, that really, I really started to think about that, in that, you know, if someone were to ask you, what does the term equity really mean today? How would you define that?
Well, again, I would say that it has to do with impact. So, but it's interestingly enough, it also has to do with process. So in the sense of impact, it means that equity is, we are looking for ways that every young person feels that their gifts and talents are supported and nurtured, that their path, their individual path to the career that is best suited for them, to their life past K-12 education, is well supported. So we're looking for the outcome that would say that we've changed the disparities, but it's significantly about a process. So to me, equity is also about what was named in that core belief, about looking at systems of power and empowerment, and recognizing that for young people to actualize their dreams, they need to feel empowered. Their families need to feel empowered. That we have to look at who's making decisions and how they're being made. So equity is about a process of empowering people's voices to self-determine their lives. You know, bell hooks had a very succinct quote about oppression. Oppression is the absence of choice. So if what we're trying to do is create more liberatory spaces, we actually need to be able to say, what would have to be different about choice so that any young person could say, I'm seen, I'm supported, and my choices will be actualized. The John Powell, we use a lot of John Powell's work. Mm-hmm. He's a professor emeritus at the Berkeley, the UC Berkeley School of the Haas Institute for a Fair and Inclusive Society. And a lot of his work has been guided by the concept of targeted universalism. So at the heart of targeted universalism is equity. It's saying that we have a universal goal. We want all of our young people to have access to those dreams that we were speaking of and to their career college choice. But we have to have targeted approaches. And this is a time when I think schools and districts actually need to say that they need to prioritize what it would mean to redesign so that those students who have been historically marginalized are at the center of the design. That going forward is not enough to say, we're going to do this and, oh, what can we do in addition? No, the targeted strategy would say that I'm centralizing that. It's Madison Metropolitan School District put into their 5-year strategic plan a year or two ago that Black excellence would be centralized. That was a targeted universalism approach. They said, we have to put our focus on those students who have been most marginalized and create a system that's working for them. And what we believe is, if we can create a system that works for them, we will all benefit. Which is connected to one of those core beliefs you were asking about, the notion that we're a human ecosystem, that we will all do better when we are all healthy, and we are all unwell when some of us are not healthy. So equity is really about taking a targeted universalism approach to your work.
My next to last question for you is, how do we make sure that we always include in a true nature parents and students when school districts, when school boards, when school administrators are making those key important decisions when it comes to, and not just curriculum, which of course is important, but every aspect of how schools are run and areas of equity and just how the school districts are making all the important decisions?
Mm-hmm. I know. It's a great question from a school board member. Well, I think a couple things come to mind. One, that leaders throughout a school system need to have an awareness that that's necessary. They need to have an awareness of their role and their responsibility in bringing student voice to the table. And then they need some skill with that. So often I find that a district does that most successfully when there are some key partnerships with either a leader within the system or a parent leader who is a strong organizer and able to help bridge the conversation. It's one thing to say, come to this meeting. We want to hear your voice. It's another thing to be able to say, we're going to make these decisions in this meeting. These kind of terms are going to be used. This is what's critical about this decision. And there's going to be different options that are going to be considered. You're going to hear these acronyms used. This is what they mean. What do you think? Now, how would you want to express your opinion? So that parents are on the inside track. We actually have to think about the way that you bridge the conversation, because every field has its own lexicon, and it can actually be a way of creating a barrier unintentionally. So I would say those are the two things in my mind, is really the awareness and then the skill of leaders throughout the system, because I think it's critical for teachers to be able to tap parents to bring to that conversation, and site administrators and district administrators. They all may have different touch points of the parents whose voices have not been heard as significantly. And you know, as a school board member, often you hear most from the parents who are most comfortable in, they're either most comfortable in that setting or they're quite upset and they bring their emotion, but they're not sure what they need to say to influence your thinking. So we have to bridge that relationship, I think.
Sure. And my last question is sort of a two-part question. So it's actually two questions. Is what are some of the new and exciting projects that the National Equity Project is, are currently involved in?
Well, like everyone else, we're in the virtual world. So one of the things that's happening is we're really experimenting a lot with creating learning environments that are virtual, and even helping people get access to just exactly what you did, going on to our website and seeing a virtual learning session. So that's definitely part of the work we're doing. I would say most exciting for me is last year we began a regional network in the Midwest that involved districts from Wisconsin, Illinois, and Michigan. And we began that with students as co-facilitators. And by that I mean high school and then high school graduates, college students, who helped design, guide, and lead the work. And it has been transformative for all of us. So that work is both leveraging this idea of networking between districts. The districts are bringing vertical teams, a superintendent with some principals, district level leaders, teachers, and students to the convening. Each of the districts is going through the work we're talking about here. What does it take to examine and redesign and pilot some work in our system, but all the way along the way, learning from the students how we're getting the impact we're looking for. And then really actively engaging students in helping with the design and the feedback loop and the examination of the impact. Is it, in what way are we really reaching that impact? It has, it's just taken us to a new level, I think. And that network success last year meant that this coming year, we're launching two more networks, and there's a fourth one on the way. So we're looking at regional networks as well as national networks of districts. Just popped onto our website today, a partnership with a funder, with the Rakes Foundation, that helped a network of educational support organizations to launch a framework guiding districts in this type of work. So it just, that there in the 25 years, this is an organization that has been amazingly adaptive and evolved constantly. And it's part of what makes it exciting to work with this group of leaders.
So if any of our listeners, are interested in getting involved, going to their school districts, to their boards of education, to their school administrators, how do they get things started? What do educators, board members, or parents or students need to do to get something started?
Well, I would say in connection with the National Equity Project, there's small and bigger ways, right? So it's looking online. What are some of those virtual learning opportunities? Sign up with a group of colleagues or with a set of families and colleagues to join that, and then have a conversation to kind of begin the discussion of a shared dialogue, being able to look at your system. And then there's definitely connections on our website, and that's just nationalequityproject.org. You can find it online to be able to tap into what else is happening in my region. You know, so we help people make those connections with what's going on in their region. I know for three of the districts that were involved in that CESA 2 learning experience last year are in the process of signing up to be a part of one of those networks for the coming year. Mm-hmm. So it's also just kind of listening in on the connections in your region, to go and visit and talk to leaders in your region that are starting this work and seeing what are you doing? How can we get connected? How do we start to learn with and from each other?
Okay, well, I really appreciate you taking your time to talk with me today, and to share some really exciting things going on with the National Equity Project.
Thank you so much for this opportunity, Steve. It's been great. I appreciate it.
And my guest this morning on Education Matters has been Heidi Gill, who is Senior Associate with the National Equity Project. This has been Education Matters here on WGTD HD, serving Kenosha, Racine, and Walworth counties. I'm Steve Brown. Thank you so much for listening.
You've been listening to Education Matters, heard each Saturday morning at 10:30 on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. Archived programs are available on our website, WGTD.org, and you're invited to continue the discussion on the Education Matters Facebook page. Support comes from Kenosha Harbor Market, featuring Mua Family Produce from Dane County, a vendor since 2011. Expect to find the usual lineup of produce as each crop is harvested this growing season. The market is open Saturdays from 9 until 2 on 2nd Avenue. Support comes from Gateway, with a message for students who, for one reason or another, have decided against returning to their college or university this fall. Classes with transfer credit are available here. To learn more, sign up for a July 1st online workshop at gtc.edu/quickstart.
Support comes from Jack Andrea, Kenosha's hometown store since 1911. They may be closed, but they haven't lost their hometown spirit. Visit jackandrea.com to shop their exclusive hometown collection, including Kenosha t-shirts, sweatshirts, mugs, books, and more. WGTD-FM is now available on your smart speaker. Simply say, play WGTD on TuneIn and hear WGTD programming. 24/7 Jazz is also available. Simply